recap and quickly finish off. So at the end of yesterday's lecture, we got to the stage where we derived the joint spectral amplitude for the photons coming out of a down conversion source. So the point was that typically the spectra of the photons are correlated, so we can't describe each photon with its own spectral amplitude function. We have to describe the two photons with a joint spectral amplitude function. And we were looking at type 2 spontaneous parametric down conversion, which just means that the output photons have different polarizations, orthogonal polarizations. And so we got to a stage where we wrote down the two photon state coming out of a down converter. So you can see we have two creation operators that tell us we have two photons, and then we have this function f, which is our joint spectral amplitude. And we derived that the function f was a product of the pump spectral function, so that's the spectral distribution of the incoming pulse laser, times something known as the phase matching function, which I will call the PMF later on. And the phase matching function depends on the material properties of the crystal. So the phase matching function is a function of delta k, which tells us how the wave vectors of the different fields relate to each other. So the wave vectors are also functions of the frequency. And because we already got energy conservation, the wave vector for the pump is actually just a function of the sum of the down-converted frequencies. So the thing that I didn't tell you yesterday was that we can Taylor expand this this wave vector. So typically it's not a very nice function. We don't have analytical expressions for it, but we have these things called Selmayr equations, which tell us what all of these coefficients are of the Taylor expansion, and they're typically things that are measured experimentally. So if you have some particular material, you can look up the manufacturer's website and it tells you what all of these coefficients would be for your to plug into your Taylor expansion. So if we just take a second order expansion, so for the down converted fields, we Taylor expand around mu, when mu is going to be this average frequency of the two photons. And for the pump, we Taylor expand around 2 mu, because 2 mu is, well, due to energy conservation, it's going to be twice the mean frequency of the down-converted photons. So if we do this Taylor expansion, then we can rearrange this phase mismatch to get something that is this constant, which gives us the phase matching. I'll describe in a second what that is. And then we also get something else that is another constant multiplied by the frequency of either the one or the other down-converted fields. And so that's what we call group velocity matching. And that's because it depends on these parameters here, which are related to the group velocities. So the group velocities are typically the derivative of omega as a function of k, but you can see that they're related to each other. So, I'll come back again to what effect the phase matching and the group velocity matching has. Okay, so then we saw that this phase matching function, when we integrated over all of the length of the crystal, we got something that was this sine x on x function. And we saw that we could approximate it as a Gaussian. So sine x on x is this big peak and it has these ripples on the side, but then we can approximate it as a Gaussian with this coefficient gamma equals 0.193. And I didn't finish writing this. But then I showed you that to get the to get a picture of what the joint spectral amplitude looks like, we draw the pump function, which is always diagonal because it's a function of the sum of the two, anti-diagonal, because it's a function of the sum of the two frequencies. and its width depends on just the spectral width of the photon coming in. And then the phase matching function, it's going to not have a fixed orientation, but also we're assuming it has a Gaussian cross-section. And then when we multiply these things together, you get something that looks like this correlated joint spectrum. So I already told you that we can control the width of this function just by changing the spectral width of the pump coming in. But I can control this function. So one knob that I have is this phase matching. So it's this thing here. So if I change that, what that lets me do is just shift this function around. Like I keep the same orientation, but I can just move it up and down. But if I play around with the group velocity matching, then what I can do is I can rotate this function about the mean point mu. So that gives us some freedom. And then the other thing that I can do, so we can see that it depends on the length of the waveguide, and it's actually inversely proportional to the length. So if I have a long waveguide, I'm going to have a very narrow phase matching function. But if I have a really short waveguide, then I have a really wide phase matching function. So then I mentioned that it's actually useful sometimes to approximate this sync function as a Gaussian. And one place where it's useful is if we're actually trying to find out what the conditions are to create a factorizable joint spectral amplitude. So what I can do is if I assume that I have a Gaussian pump, so there should be a squared somewhere. So this is a Gaussian pump centered at 2 mu. And now I have my Gaussian phase matching function. And I multiply these two together. And I know that delta k is going to be a function of these terms that have omegas, omega o's and omega e's. So if I want this to factorize, what I need to make sure is that I eliminate all cross terms. So by cross terms, I mean things that are products of omega o and omega e. Because I want only things that are a function of omega o and only things that are a function of omega e. So if you expand this out, you can find that the condition for getting rid of these cross terms is something like this. So it depends on the pump width, the length, and also the difference of these inverse group velocities. So you can kind of see where that comes from, because we have things that have that form times omega e and things that have that form times omega o. So we need to satisfy that condition. And one of the ways that you can satisfy it is if you set the group velocity of the pump to be an average of the group velocities of the two outcoming photons. And if you set the length to depend on the pump, width like that. And so choosing these parameters gives you a phase matching function that's perpendicular to the pump function. And choosing the length like that matches the width of this function to the width of that function. And so then when you multiply them together, you get a nice decorrelated Gaussian. So that's what you want. But of course, we only approximated this phase matching function to be Gaussian. And in reality, you're going to have these side lobes. And they're still, like, they're actually quite detrimental, because if you calculate the purity of each photon with these side lobes, it's going to be something like 0.87. And you want it to be close to one. So there are techniques for actually eliminating these side lobes in the phase matching function, which I'm not going to go into. But if you want, you can check out this paper, which just came out. And so, I won't have time to go into those. But you can, using these techniques, you can get the purities up to 0.999, at least theoretically. Okay, so that was a whirlwind wrap-up of yesterday's lecture. So I'll give you guys a minute or so to process it and let me know if you have any questions about that before we move on to today's lecture. Are there any questions? Everyone's still writing. Okay. If there are no questions, I'll move on to the next bit. Yeah, I also pre-prepared this slide because it's just a recap of what you already know. So hopefully we can go through that pretty quickly too. Okay, so in this lecture, I'm going to talk about coherent state, linear optical, quantum computing. But before I do that, I just wanted to remind you of the other encoding that you're familiar with, which is this single photon encodings. So we saw two different types of encodings. One of them was the dual rail encoding, where our qubit was encoded in the path of one of the photons. So if it was in path A, we called this 0, and if it was in path B, we called this 1. You could do single qubit gates with linear optics. It was pretty easy. Or you had the polarization encoding, where a logical 0 was encoded into the horizontal polarization of the photon, and a logical 1 was encoded into the vertical polarization of the photon. And you could do single qubit gates with other types of linear optics, like half-wave plates, phase shifters, and so on. So single qubit gates were easy. Entangling gates were really hard. That's because single photon nonlinearities are really weak, so we could never get the right phase shifts, the nonlinear phase shifts, to entangle our photons. We saw that there were linear optical schemes like the KLM scheme, but it was very resource heavy. And something I don't think was mentioned, but Bell bases measurements in this single photon encoding using just linear optics and photon counting, they have a maximum success probability of a half. So I don't have any particular insight to give you about why that's the case, but there's a proof of that in this paper. And the reason I'm pointing it out is because that's something that's going to be not true in the coherent state LOQC that I'll talk about. And so you might remember that the Bell states were this set of four entangled orthogonal states. And the reason a measurement in that basis was important is because it's what allowed us to do teleportation. So if we started off with an entangled state shared between Alice and Bob, and Alice had this state that she wanted to teleport to Bob, she would make a Bell measurement on these two qubits, and then she would have two binary outcomes. So 0001, 1011, and based on the results of those measurements, she would communicate it to Bob, and then Bob would correct his state and get this output. Okay. not a good start. Okay. So that was the single photon encoding. Here we'll talk about the situation where we use coherent states to encode our photons. So recall that a coherent state can be written in the Fock basis. So it's a superposition of different photon number states, and we can draw the Wigner function for that state. So it has a minimum uncertainty circle here, and then the distance from the origin tells us the average photon number, and also the orientation away from the q-axis tells us the phase of this coherent state. And it'll be useful to know that if we send two coherent states on a beam splitter, what we get out is two coherent states with different amplitudes. So say that I have a beam splitter of reflectivity eta, and I send in a coherent state alpha and a coherent state beta, then I get two separable states out, which are coherent states with amplitudes root eta times alpha plus 1 minus root eta times beta. And then the other one is going to be 1 minus eta alpha minus root eta beta. So we should be able to see that if this was a 50-50 beam splitter and these two were the same coherent state, then you'd get constructive interference in one port and destructive interference in the other one. Okay, so now consider that we have two different coherent states that have the same amplitude but different phase. So these states, they're not orthogonal. But their overlap is very small, especially if alpha gets large. So you can see that it decreases exponentially with mod alpha squared. So for example, for mod alpha equals 2, then the overlap is roughly around 10 to the minus 7. So it's already quite small. And so then what we do is we identify plus and minus alpha as being our computational basis.
So we say that alpha is our logical zero state and minus alpha is the logical one state. And so then we can write an arbitrary qubit as a superposition of those. So psi is mu alpha plus mu minus alpha, where mu and nu are complex numbers. Okay, so then we have a pretty simple method of unambiguously discriminating between the two basis states. And we do that by interfering our state on a beam splitter. With a coherent state of the same amplitude. So, and this is on a 50-50 beam splitter. So, under the beam splitter, if we take our arbitrary state with this coherent state alpha, and just follow those transformations, we see that the state evolves to a superposition of mu root 2 alpha in one mode and nothing in the other mode, plus nu nothing in one mode and root 2 alpha in the other mode. So you can see now that if I do photon counting, if I detect photons in this mode but no photons in that mode, then I know I had the state corresponding to the zero logical state, and vice versa. If I detect photons here and no photons there, then I had the logical state for then I detected the logical one state. And so when it works, it unambiguously discriminates between these two, but it also has a probability of failure. So it's got a non-zero prob of failure. And that happens if we measure the outcome 0, 0, and 0, 0 in both of the, those modes. Right. So the probability of failure goes to zero as alpha increases, and we also know when it fails. So it does fail sometimes, but at least, you know, we know when that happens. Alternatively, if you wanted, you could encode your states in an orthogonal basis. Which, if you want, you can call the cat state basis. And so here, one of our basis states is going to be a superposition with a sum of two coherent states. So we'll call that our logical zero, and the other one is a superposition with a different phase. And we can call that our logical one. And okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write it out. So the reason this is, I call this E and D. It's supposed to stand for even and odd. But it's not an O because that gets really confusing with the zero state. And the reason that they are even and odd states is if we, let's look at our coherence. Okay, so you can see the coherence state is in the number bases. So if we add two coherence states with different phases, then here all of the odd photon numbers are going to cancel, and here all of the even photon numbers are going to cancel. And so we can actually write it out in the Fock basis as well. Sorry if this is really small here. But so as you can see here, the even cat only has even photon number terms, and the odd cat has odd photon number terms. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you how we can do teleportation using this particular basis. So for teleportation, we need a source of entangled states, and we also need to know how to make Bell basis measurements. So let's first describe the Bell basis measurement. Okay, I didn't write down what the Bell states were, but I think we can figure it out. So there'll be some sort of coefficient out the front, which I don't have right now, but you can see that this is analogous to the Bell states we had up there. Oh, I do have them written down. So the Bell measurement is then, we take a beam splitter. That seems to be the standard approach. And so it's a 50-50 beam splitter, and we put in, so let's label this A, B. So now the Bell state, it's a two-photon state, so we put one part of the Bell state in here and the other part in there. And then we can calculate what happens when the Bell state interferes with itself on the beam splitter. So we see that one state, okay, so for starters, they become separable states. But they also become separable states that you can differentiate. Okay, so we can see that for each of these four states, you either get a vacuum state in one mode and an even cat in the other mode, or a vacuum state in one mode or an odd cat, or vice versa. So where now this even and odd cat have been defined here, so it's just a slightly larger cat. Does everyone know why we call them cat states? I don't think I talked about that, but I'm not sure if I mentioned it in the tutorial. Sorry, what was your question? And then we can come back to
all the even cat states, you still have probability of failure.
Zero. Yeah. I'll mention that in a second. So, okay, let me first address why they're called cat states. So the coherence state is sometimes thought of as a classical state. But it's a macroscopic state of light. It's got many, 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 many photons. And if you take a superposition of these two macroscopic states of light that are almost orthogonal, then the analogy is between alpha being the alive cat and minus alpha being the dead cat. And then you have a superposition of these two things. So the macroscopic superposition of the superposition of macroscopic states is the analog to Schrödinger's cat. And then, like I said, we call them odd and even because they have odd and even photon numbers. And so now, just to finish off this measurement, so we see that we interfere the cat with itself on the beam splitter, and then we have to do photon number counting here again. And now what we do is a parity measurement. So if we get an odd number or an even number of photons, then we know whether we had an even cat or an odd cat. And so you can see that not only is this a way of performing the Bell measurement, we can go in reverse and use it also as a method of preparing the entangled state that we need as a resource for the teleportation. So now if we, let's say we want to use this as our entangled resource, then we just need to prepare a diagonal cat of amplitude root to alpha, send it on a beam splitter, split it up, and then create this entangled state. Yeah, okay, and also as Nick pointed out, there is going to be a probability of failure, which corresponds to just getting 0, 0 in both outputs. But that probability of failure is known, so we know when it happens, and it's small as alpha gets bigger. So then we can just quickly summarize what the teleportation protocol looks like. So to prepare our entangled state, we put a diagonal cat in one mode and the vacuum state in the other mode, into split it up on a beam splitter. And then let's say we have our arbitrary state that we're trying to teleport. We then want to do a Bell measurement on these two. So what we do is we interfere these two qubits on a beam splitter, and then we do photon counting. And then based on the output of based on the outcome of this photon counting measurement, then we implement an X or a Z gate. And so this is only dependent on whether this is an odd or an even outcome. And of course, there's going to be this probability of failure, which happens when both M and N are equal to zero. So then how do we do these corrections? Well, the X correction is really easy. So what we want to do is take alpha to minus alpha and minus alpha to alpha. So that's just a phase shift, which is easy to implement. Unfortunately, the Z correction is really hard. So what you want to do is leave alpha alone and introduce a phase shift in front of the minus alpha. So one strategy you could use is to just perform the teleportation again locally and just hope that you undo the X error. It's not very satisfying, but as we see later on, it turns out not to be such a big problem. So I'll come back to that later.
Question.
Yes.
The state you're teleporting.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be using the alternative even odd basis or the alpha and alpha basis?
You can use which basis you like, because I can just rewrite this in that alternative basis and I'll have different coefficients out the front in front of my qubit. It's not a problem that they're not completely orthogonal. So it's not like you have to use this orthogonal basis. It's just a preference. Okay, so I explained how to do teleportation. Ultimately, one would like to do universal quantum computing. So to do universal quantum computing, you need to do these single qubit operations. So you would like this sequence, Hadamard rotation about Z by some angle, another Hadamard, and rotation about Z by another angle. And then you also want to be able to do an entangling gate, which is the C sine gate. So there are methods for doing all of those gates in this encoding. I'm not going to go through all of them because it would be very tedious and time consuming. I will say something about them though, but if you want more details than what I'm going to tell you, I recommend checking out this paper. It's actually a really nice paper, and it's the paper that I'm basing most of this lecture on. So if you didn't catch everything that I'm saying, you can go back and have a look at this paper as well. Okay, so one thing I did want to point out is that that all of these that all of these gates, they rely on being able to prepare this particular resource state. And this particular resource state can be prepared non-deterministically using the teleportation gate that I just described. And so you might be really worried that now every single gate is that I do is going to have this situation where I have a Z error that I can't correct, and you know that I have to correct maybe probabilistically by doing another teleportation, which doesn't seem like a good state of affairs. But there's good news. And the good news is that the Z error, it commutes with the C sine gate. And on top of that, if I do a Hadamard, commutes with the C sine and with the Z rotations. And on top of that, if I do a Hadamard in my computation, it's going to change my Z error into an X error that I can then correct. So the strategy that you can take is that every time I have an X error, I just correct it with this phase shift, that's easy. And I just keep note of the Z errors until I get a Hadamard in my computation, which changes my Z error into an X error, and then I correct it. I might introduce a new Z error, which I keep track of, but that's okay, I just keep propagating these errors and correcting them when I can. And so at worst, at the end, you'll be left with one Z error that you need to correct, but it's not like you need to correct all of these Z errors all the way along. Okay, and how big does alpha need to actually be? Well, for universal quantum computing, if we use fault tolerant error correction, then does anyone want to guess? How big do you think alpha would need to be? Pick a number, any number. 10. Anyone else? Sorry? No, yeah, okay. I don't know if alpha has dimension. Anyone else? Are there any numbers up here that we see?
One.
Okay. No. The number I was going for was 2. So initially it was thought that alpha needed to be 2, around 2, because that's when the overlap is small, but it was eventually shown that alpha only needs to be as small as roughly around 1.2. Why are you nodding and agreeing? You said one. Okay, it's close enough to one. No, no. Very good. Yeah.
What would it be on average, roughly?
Well, alpha mod alpha squared is the average number of photons. And then the average, which is going to be proportional to the intensity of the laser.
Do you have numerical values on the top of your head?
It's going to depend on the frequency of the laser. Yeah. I'm thinking, okay, the thing that's like coming to mind right now is h bar omega times mod alpha squared, but like I'll need to double check that. Yeah. So that's going to be the energy of the laser. But yeah, somehow that's going to map to the intensity. Yeah. So there are two things that I wanted to finish off in the next 10 minutes. I wanted to go through the scheme for how we produce the Schrodinger cat states in the lab, which I touched on in the discussion yesterday. And I wanted to tell you about decoherence. So maybe I'll just really quickly go through the production of the cat states. So these odd and even cat states are called odd and even because they have odd numbers of photons or even numbers of photons. And we're already familiar with another type of state that has only even numbers of photons, which I'm not going to make you tell me what it is, but I'm sure you know that it's the squeezed vacuum state. And you might remember that the squeezed vacuum state can be created by putting a coherent state into a nonlinear crystal, and then what comes out is the squeezed vacuum. And so this state does have some overlap with the even cat state, but it's not very good, and it's a Gaussian state. And I mean, it's okay, but it's not great. But what we can do is create a state that has even number terms just by subtracting a single photon from this squeezed vacuum state. So if we subtract a single photon, we get a state that looks like annihilation operator acting on the squeezed vacuum. And we can write it out in the number bases. So then what we can do, we'd like to know how well it approximates the squeezed the odd cat state that we're trying to make. And the way that we do that is we calculate the fidelity between the two states. So you may remember that the fidelity between the state psi and the state phi, if they're pure state, it's easy to calculate. You just take the overlap between these states and mod alpha squared. And so you can see it'll be a pretty easy calculation. Wherever is the even? I don't know where he is. Oh, yeah, here. So we just take this guy and the inner product of that guy. And most of the terms are going to go to zero, except for the ones where 2n plus 1 matches. And then we get something that is the sum over the products of these coefficients and those coefficients. So it'll be a function of alpha and this squeezing parameter. These are all really gross expressions. And there are going to be some squeezing parameters that match some alphas better. So you can actually optimize this function. So it's going to be maximized when the squeezing parameter depends on the coefficient alpha as follows. So just to give you an intuition for what it looks like, I'm going to plot the fidelity. And I'll plot it between alpha is equal to 2 and alpha is equal to 0. And then the fidelity on that y-axis, it's going to go from 0.88 to 1. So around 1, it's even still really, really good. But then it just starts to drop off. So you see at 2, it's like it's still pretty, I mean, and then it just goes off. It's pretty high at 0.88. Around 1.2, it's really high, something like 0.99. Okay, and how do we experimentally subtract a single photon? Well, we put a very weakly reflecting beam splitter here and wait for it to detect a single photon. And then what comes out is a photon subtracted, squeezed vacuum state. Okay, and in my last, I don't know if I'll have time to do this well. Okay, so the last thing I want to tell you about is decoherence. So decoherence is when our quantum state interacts with its environment and then becomes entangled with the environment, and as a result, we lose coherence. And so in this case, if we have a cat, the coherence that we're going to lose is the coherence between alpha and minus alpha. And so I was going to do the whole calculation. I won't do the whole thing. Okay, so there's something known as the James-Cummings Hamiltonian, which tells you how a single atom inside a cavity interacts with a electromagnetic field. And so I wanted to do a really simple model of decoherence here, where I took my cat state and then just interacted it with a single atom rather than an entire environment. And then we were going to trace out the atom. So I won't have time to motivate this Hamiltonian, but the interaction that we're going to look at is going to be it'll have some sort of energy, and then we're going to have a interaction between the field and the two-level atom. So these create and annihilate photons, and these operators take our atom from the ground in the excited state. So sigma minus is going to take an excited, maybe I should do it like this. Excited atom down to the ground state, and sigma plus is going to take a ground state atom into the excited state. So you can see if you lose a photon, you're going to gain some energy in the atom. If you gain a photon, you're going to lose some energy in the atom. And then we can consider the evolution under this interaction Hamiltonian, and I'm just going to take it to first order. So I will get something that is the identity minus the something that depends on the Hamiltonian. And I'm going to start off with my cat state being an even cat state, and my, let's call it capital E, and my atom being in the ground state. And so the identity acting on that is going to do nothing. So I'll have my the state that I started off with. But, and this term acting on here is just going to disappear because I'm already in a ground state, so I can't go back down any further. But this state is going to subtract a photon from the even cat state and create an excitation in the atom. So essentially what you get is that the even cat state turns into an odd cat state. And we can go through this more carefully in the tutorial. But hopefully you should be able to see how, now we'll go through it in the tutorial. Okay, so we get something and some coefficients at the front. So we get something that is a even cat state entangled with the ground state of the atom, and something that's an odd cat state entangled with the excited state of the atom. And if we then trace out the atom, we're going to get something that looks like a incoherent mixture of an odd state, odd cat state, and an even cat state. And so just to show you what that would look like with the Wigner functions. So the Wigner function for the even cat state is going to be, so you've got your bits corresponding to plus alpha and minus alpha, and then you have these interference fringes in the middle. And the Wigner function for the odd cat state is again going to be these side lobes corresponding to alpha and minus alpha. But the interference fringes are going to be out of phase with the interference fringes for the even cat state. And you might remember in the tutorial when I told you that if we're adding incoherently different states, then we just add the Wigner functions together. So if we add these two together, and then normalize it, the bits corresponding to alpha and minus alpha won't change, but we're going to have destructive interference between these interference fringes here. So they will just eventually wash out. So as time goes on, these interference fringes wash out, and all we're left with is these bits here corresponding to alpha and minus alpha. So this is now it's just a super incoherent mixture of alpha and minus alpha. So what I've quickly tried to sketch out here is that if we start off with a coherent superposition of these alpha and minus alpha, which is our cat state, and then it interacts with the environment, this interaction is going to wash out these fringes, and we'll just be left with a incoherent mixture. And with that, I'll wrap up the lecture. And if there are any questions, we can just take them on the side while the next lecturer prepares. So thanks.